The Tom Woods Show, episode 2157.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Scott Horton is with us once again, and today we are actually going to talk to Scott, who, by the way, in case you don't know, is the great, amazing, extraordinary foreign policy expert we are so lucky to have here in the libertarian community. By the way, you should listen to The Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. He's also the host of Anti-War Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. He directs the Libertarian Institute. He's editorial director of antiwar.com. I'm sure he probably does a million other things. But we're going to talk today about a brand new book he has called Hotter Than the Sun, Time to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Scott Horton, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? Happy to be here.
I am doing well. So Hotter Than the Sun is your latest book. This is not quite what I expected, because I was under the impression that it would just be entirely a brief for getting rid of nuclear weapons. And of course, there is some of that, but all the topics you cover, it's everything you would want. You talk about the rogue states and nuclear proliferation, and talk about Hiroshima, Nagasaki, an episode from history. And of course, all this, the politics surrounding getting rid of nuclear weapons or trying to halt proliferation. So what I was interested in, there's an interview you have here, because this is a collection of interviews you've done over the years, and man, have you done a lot. You make me look like a lazy bum. But you have an interview in here talking about, this is an interview from 2017, about a treaty to ban nuclear weapons that did later go into effect without the United States as a signatory. And I want to address this, because as I was reading this, I thought, there's the old Scott Horton we all love. Because you were saying to the interviewee, you were saying, look, this is an area where we need to be able to say to people who aren't on the left, we need to say to them, look, this, to some of you, you may think this is some hippie thing, like this is a Jane Fonda thing, we got to get rid of nuclear weapons. But then you can find so many Republicans and even Republican presidents who have actually made real strides toward reducing the number of nuclear weapons in the world. Actually, the number of warheads, nuclear warheads in the world, is much, much lower today than it used to be. And a good chunk of that actually has to do with, believe it or not, Republican officials. And so we need to remind the Republican masses of this. And I thought, there's old Scott. You know, you got to outflank him from the right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, so on this treaty, the treaty is called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And I know from reactions, good and bad, to the book, and even just to the title, right?
Almost all of them have been just to the title.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Because hardly anyone's read the thing yet. But it sounds like hippie utopian stuff. I'm trying to essentially argue that, no, this is a completely rational and reasonable point of view, that maybe nukes were necessary to fend off the Reds back when or something. But it just can't be that this has to be the permanent state of affairs for the next 75 years or 700 years, or the kind of indefinite future of mankind, that these powerful nation states will be holding hydrogen bombs to the head of all of mankind in this ultimate Mexican standoff that better never fail. And mutually assured destruction works great until the day it fails. And the day it fails, then we're talking about billions of people dying, not just in the Northern Hemisphere from a trade-off of nuclear missiles with Russia or with China, but from the nuclear winter and the famine that would come with that, that would last, you know, a decade or more, you'd have billions of people lay down and die around the world. And it's just, it's ridiculous, frankly, that the idea is that, nope, that's just the way it is, and that's the way it has to be. And we have to consider it that way. And any other way of looking at it is Jane Fonda or Michael Moore or some naive hippie girl in a sundress who doesn't know, and you'll just have to leave security to us tough guys, and that it's just as black and white and as simple as that. I know it's not true. And I knew that I was kind of digging my own grave a little bit by naming the book that, in a way. And it's sort of the same thing as I did with Fool's Errand and Enough Already. I titled them Time to End the War in Afghanistan and Time to End the War on Terrorism, when they both could have probably better been called A History of These Wars, or
yes, right.
God's
yeah,
version
yeah.
of what really is going on here, or you know, something like that. Because time to call this all off, that isn't really to the last page of either of those books.
Right.
But I just figured, well, what the hell? That's what I'm going for here, and that's what I want, and I'm just going to put that right up front, that that's the argument. But the argument is not going to be kind of abstract, right? It's going to be a Hortonian argument, meaning just a, or I shouldn't say that, a Chomskyite type argument or a Bovardian argument, where it's just an absolute pummeling with facts until you have to give in, right? But it's just a stack of assertions of fact rather than a bunch of deep thinking and considering and value weighing and all these things. It's much more just kind of a history. So with this thing, as you said, it's all over the place. We cover essentially every aspect of nuclear weapons. And I should say right up front here too, that all the credit here goes to Jared Wall, who is my sponsor. He sells that legal Delta 8 weed at thehempspot.com, THC for thehempspot.com. And he's a longtime fan and friend of the show. And he just emailed me one day, Tom, and he goes, look what I did. And it's a 350-page book of transcripts already edited.
What? He did that?
Perfectly.
Okay, then
yeah,
I will let you get away with promoting his sponsor thing on my show.
I'll, yeah, exactly. No, he deserves it. I wouldn't have taken that liberty from you, Tom, except that, yeah, no, I kind of
had to. No, my gosh, anybody you know? Who did that service for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, so then we went through it together, and I said, well, let's cut this one and this one, but let's add this one and this one and this and that, and then I really was putting it on the back burner because my highest priority is I'm writing a book with Daryl Cooper from the Martyr Made podcast as my co-author. And we're working on a book about the background to the Russia-Ukraine war. And I really had to put that on hold for a month or 6 weeks or something, and almost, to get this thing out. So I almost didn't do it. I almost was just going to leave it on the back burner until the Russia book was done. And then I thought, oh man, I better go ahead and get this thing out now while I can. That way,
yeah,
if we all do die in a nuclear war, my last words can be told you so, you know?
Yeah, right, right. At least we'll have that. By the way, just to return to something I said before, I didn't realize that there had been, and I guess it's nuclear warheads we're talking about, there had been something like 70,000 of them,
yes,
and
sir.
Now there are closer to 14,000 of them, which is a pretty dramatic decrease. So number one, I thought that was kind of interesting. Let's just get out
wait,
of the
let's
way.
Let's stick with that for a sec, because
yeah, sure.
That goes back to what you brought up before about the Republicans supporting this, and that was kind of a tangent I should have taken there about this is the proof. Just like when Ron Paul got up there and had his Giuliani moment about terrorism and all that, this is the proof that you don't have to be any kind of leftist to disagree with the status quo on this issue. And that is that it was Ronald Reagan who came within a hair of negotiating the complete abolition of nuclear weapons with Mikhail Gorbachev, Tom, in 86 at their meeting at Reykjavik, Iceland, when, as far as anybody knew, the Soviet Union was going to last into the new century. And, you know, the wall didn't come down till the end of 88. So they were beginning to end the Cold War, but they were not beginning to end communism's grip on Eastern Europe for another couple of years. It was still the big red menace. And Ronald Reagan said enough of this and decided he was on a mission from God to abolish nuclear weapons. And Joe Cirincione, who I interview in the book, tells the story because he got it all straight from George Shultz, the Secretary of State. And he said it was Reagan, Shultz, Gorbachev, and the translator were the only ones in the room. And Reagan says, let's get rid of all these short and mid-range missiles. You'll remember he poured them into Europe to counter the Soviets' mid-range missiles, all those Pershings and everything. Now here he is, he's trading them all away. This is known as the INF Treaty. He did get this done. This is the INF Treaty of 1987, the one that Donald Trump tore up, that Biden refused to reinstate, that helped lead to the current war, by the way. This was Reagan's great accomplishment, was getting rid of all the short and mid-range missiles out of Europe. So he said that. And then Gorbachev said, well, let's get rid of all the long-range missiles too. And Reagan turned to Shultz and said, can we do that? And Shultz said, yes, sir, Mr. President, we sure as hell can. And Reagan said, okay, let's do it. Let's start talking about it. And then, so they started talking about it, but Gorbachev said, you know, from my side, you'll have to drop your insistence on this new defensive anti-missile shield, which as we know, especially now, 30 years in the future here, 40 years in the future, pardon me, almost 35, this whole Star Wars thing was a total fantasy. It still doesn't work. The anti-missile missiles, much less lasers in space and all this, is a total hoax. And yet you'll be shocked, but not surprised to find out that it was Richard Perle, the Prince of Darkness, who was as powerful as any of the neocons like Paul Wolfowitz and his other friends who lied us into Iraq War II, known as the Prince of Darkness. That's what he calls himself, who pressured Reagan, essentially manipulated him and said that you'll be betraying your promise to the American people that you're going to build them this missile shield. Well, no missiles, no need for a missile shield. So the whole thing was ridiculous, but that was how they manipulated Reagan into abandoning the idea. But he and George Shultz at the time were serious about doing it. And they only got tripped up on this technicality that should have never gotten in their way. And then it's not I Dream a Genie, you know, or Bewitched, Wiggles her nose and everything is perfect now, or Superman 4 comes and gets rid of them all for us. But it makes total sense. And Cerencione was in there in Washington in the 80s during all this talk. And whatever, during this time, he said the idea was the US and the USSR would reduce our nuclear weapon stockpiles down to 200, which would make us essentially at parity with England and France, Israel, and China. And then, of course, you could throw in India, Pakistan, and Korea has fewer than that, but North Korea has fewer than that now. But at that time, those were the nuclear weapon states, and everybody had a couple of hundred. Basically. So the idea was we would reduce down to a couple of hundred, and then we would insist that our allies join us in going ahead and reducing down to, well, let's try 100 each. And then let's see if we can get down to 50. And then let's see if we can get down to 10. So the idea, again, it's not utopian. It's not fanciful. It's let's see how low we can go.
Yeah.
And there have been studies even by the Pentagon that said they thought we could get by with 300. Well, we got about 6,000 now. So we could go way down to just 300. That's according to the US Air Force. That probably means getting rid of the Minuteman missiles and just having the subs and the bombers and fighter bombers, which fine. In other words, let's make progress toward this goal. And by the way, the US and all the nuclear weapon states other than Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968, where we already promised to get rid of our nuclear weapons. That's our side of the deal, as long as the non-nuclear weapon states promise not to get any. And it works. I mean, that's the thing about this too. Gun control doesn't work or whatever. You can't just 3D print a nuclear bomb. You have to have a Manhattan Project to make a nuclear bomb. There essentially is no power on Earth other than nation states who are capable of building nuclear bombs. And it's virtually impossible for them to do so in secret. And if you have this huge multilateral treaty where all the powers agree to dismantle their nuclear weapons, and then somebody tries to cheat, well, then the others can rearm. As the critics insist, you can't uninvent nuclear weapons. So if Russia cheats and starts building missiles to threaten our friends in Europe, we could start building up missiles again or something like that. Whatever it is in the hypothetical, wouldn't be difficult, wouldn't be too difficult for us to do. But the thing is, it's worth trying. And it's certainly worth considering. And when you look at a group like Global Zero, it is, as you were saying there, Tom, it's a Nixon can go to China. Jimmy Carter can't go to China, but Nixon can go to China and make this deal. Ronald Reagan could make this deal with Gorbachev. His successor, George H.W. Bush, also signed multiple treaties to reduce nuclear weapons down to the current numbers. He took them off of Navy surface ships and pulled them out of the Korean Peninsula and all different kinds of things to scale back. As the Birchers complained famously then, he took all those long-range bombers and just cut them all in half and left them out in the desert to rot. We didn't need them anymore. Huge, huge reductions. And if you look at Global Zero, you can see where it's people like Henry Kissinger. George Shultz is now dead, but he was a big part of it. And you have William Perry, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, but he's not a partisan Democrat. He was a civilian wonk from the bowels of the Pentagon, a true expert's expert technocrat type. And he wrote a book about how we got to get rid of these things. I think you're just naive about how dangerous these machines are. We got to do something. So you have this whole kind of generation of these, you know, what you'd call in the Council on Foreign Relations, graybeards, right? The Brzezinskis and the Kissingers and the Rockefeller men of the world, the oldest generation of them still left, are saying, hey, we should get rid of these nukes before they start going off. This is not a magical solution to our problem to prevent war between major powers. There has to be another way. So that ought to be enough. When Henry Kissinger is saying, you know, the butcher of Laos and Cambodia is telling you, and Vietnam and Indonesia and Bangladesh, when he's telling you that this is not safe. Just like when he's telling the Davos Forum a couple of weeks ago in Switzerland there, he was saying, we need to wrap up this war in Ukraine within a couple of months at the most. And they didn't want to hear that at all, but they'll hear it from him because he's Henry the devil himself, Kissinger. And he's saying, this is too dangerous what we're doing here. And so, you know, when the Hawk's Hawk is advising you to cool it, it's at least worth paying attention to his argument there.
I'm glad you hit on all this because that was actually what I was about to ask you about. I was going to say, let's get this matter of the title of the book and stuff out of the way and see what your response to that would be. You may reference in the book at one point to the movie The Day After and saying maybe we should have an updated version of The Day After. Now, you're a little younger than I am. When I was growing up in the 80s, I remember The Day After coming on TV. It was a TV movie. And I wasn't supposed to watch it, but of course, I was a sneaky little SOB and I did watch it because I was curious to see what would happen. Not what would happen to me for watching it, what would happen to society if we had a nuclear war. But there's another movie, a British movie, that also depicts a nuclear war called Threads. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I just saw Threads a couple of weeks ago because I...
Oh, okay.
I was reading about it in a book and I had, believe it or not, I had never heard of it before. And the way it was described to me was, this is a terrifying movie. It's not a huge budget movie, but it doesn't need to be terrifying. And the way it was put to me was, nothing good happens to anyone in this film. And things just get grimmer and grimmer and grimmer. And just when you think they can't get any grimmer, they get grimmer still. And it really does make you start thinking in new ways. Sometimes, you're right, we get stuck in these conventional ways of thinking. Oh, well, we have to do it this way. And if I thought in a different way, I'd be like Jane Fonda, and you can't break out of it. But seeing something like that can actually, I think, be enough for some people to break them out of it.
Yeah. You know, this is something that comes up, and this is why there's an entire appendix to the book of who opposed nuking Japan. This
Very important.
I'm sure you have direct experience in your life as a professional historian, that when you tell people that right-wing generals and admirals were against nuking Japan, they go, what? And, you know, it's a huge light bulb goes off. Because if you oppose nuking Japan, well, that's about the most un-American pinko commie traitor position you could possibly take. The president's name was Truman, and he would not have done that if he didn't have to. And what are you, crazy commie? But then you go, oh, yeah? Well, Eisenhower was against it, and MacArthur was against it, and Nimitz was against it, and Leahy was against it. And you start going down the list. Even Curtis LeMay said they were already surrendering. The dropping of the atomic bombs had nothing to do with the end of the war at all. And it goes down the list. I'm leaving off a bunch, but it was the commanders of the Army Air Force, and of the Navy, all just said this is wrong. And including Admiral Leahy, who was the six-star Admiral Leahy, the chief of staff to Truman during wartime in World War II. And it was his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Defense and Truman, the three of them, who decided that this is what they wanted to do over the objections of essentially everybody else leading the war effort. And there was just no reason to do this. And even as we talk about in the book, they made a propaganda movie about this where they have to pretend and show Japanese fighter planes closing in on the Enola Gay and flak everywhere and all this, when we know in reality they faced no resistance whatsoever when they dropped those bombs. There was no Japanese Air Force left. There were no, you know, anti-aircraft guns firing. They had to embellish all of that because essentially they knew what they were doing was dropping bombs on defenseless cities.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about those people at the time, there's another right-winger, more of a contemporary of ours, Pat Buchanan, who in his memoir, right from the beginning, repeats his own opposition to it. He talks about being in Tokyo during the 1986 economic summit, and every morning at breakfast, he was greeted by a lovely young Japanese waitress, and he just couldn't help thinking that in 1945, he'd been taught that you were to cheer on the Americans and hate the Japanese. And he says that he talks about exactly what happened. He talks about the burning to death of tens of thousands of people. And he said, just like this waitress. And he said, my father and the Jesuits, who taught me about St. Augustine's requirements for conducting a just war and the proscription against the direct and wanton killing of innocent civilians, were right. no matter the barbarity, the savagery of the Japanese Empire, no matter the justice of America's cause, we had no moral right to kill like that. It's just as simple as that. We had no moral right to kill like that.
Yeah. And look, I mean, people got to understand too, as Daniel Ellsberg, I think very importantly, likes to emphasize, the Nagasaki bomb, that plutonium implosion bomb, that's the blasting cap for a modern thermonuclear weapon. That's what sets off the hydrogen fusion bomb. And I'm not sure about your town, but for anyone who's familiar with Austin, Texas, one H-bomb at about a megaton would kill all of Austin from Slaughter Lane to Breaker Lane, essentially. From the hills in the west all the way out, you know, past Decker Lake, would kill everyone. Jeez, I don't know. Like, don't worry, that won't ever happen.
Yeah, but that's just it. And that's exactly what I want to talk about. That won't ever happen. But here's the thing. There is a risk that it could happen, that it could even happen by accident. And this is one of the points that Caitlin Johnstone, as you may have noticed, keeps making about why it's so risky to be so bellicose toward Russia. Because she puts forth scenarios in which, you know, because we're not coordinating on keeping the missiles safe or communicating very well, that you could actually accidentally back into a nuclear confrontation, and we would prefer not to have that happen. So you have I think your first section of this book is about the risk of nuclear war. And that seems like a strange thing to say, not as strange in 2022 as maybe a couple of years ago, but after the Cold War, I think people thought, well, okay, thank goodness we dodged that bullet. But what are the risks? And are they of the sort that I'm describing here that Caitlin Johnstone is talking about?
Yes, I mean, that's absolutely part of it. As I think I tried to say in the introduction, through accident or miscalculation or malevolence, we are not safe from these things. And we've had in the past, there's a guy named Eric Schlosser, who I never did get around to reading his book or interviewing him, but you know, I read articles, you know, reviews all about it. And this guy Schlosser, and he wrote a book where he describes, I believe it was 20 instances where we came within what you would call a hair of a nuclear exchange over mostly misunderstandings. You know, one great example is when the Air Force accidentally dropped an H-bomb over North Carolina, and 8 out of 9 fail-safes on the weapon failed. And it was only the 9th that prevented it from going off. And the thing is, in a situation like that, there's what, I don't know, let's be generous and say a 50-50 chance that they would just blame it on somebody and start a war rather than admit that they screwed up and nuked their own state. And so something like that. Or maybe, you know, it just would be covered up in the chain of command and communication, and people would make assumptions about what was going on and not know, or, you know, that kind of thing. You had famously in 1993, the Norwegians fired a satellite into space, and they warned the Russians, we're going to fire this satellite into space, but it got stuck in the chain of command somewhere. Typical bureaucratic snafu, Tom, government work, you know. And so they thought they were under attack by NATO, first strike on Moscow, and they went to red alert. And I believe this was one of the cases where good old Stanley, whatever his name, didn't do his job quite deliberately, because his job would have started a war, and he decided, nah, I'm going to go ahead and not do my job and wait and see what happens. But if he had just followed the standing orders, we'd all been at war and we'd have lost a few cities before they were able to stop it. Then there's also miscalculation. And this happens all the time when we're not talking about nukes necessarily, that here, we know what's going to happen. If we do this, they'll do that. In fact, here's a quote from the New York Times from January of this year. Or this one actually might be from December of 21, Tom. I'm pretty sure it's from January, the same one where they're quoting Admiral Stavridis, who would have been Hillary's Secretary of Defense if she had won, probably, or National Security Advisor, one of the two. This is the one where he says, we don't know the first thing about defeating an insurgency, but we sure know how to back one, like we did in Afghanistan and Syria. And I'll spare you the tangent there, grumble. But in that same article, pretty sure it's that same article, it's definitely New York Times, they say, we're very carefully calibrating the amount of weapons that we're pouring into Ukraine. We want to pour in just enough weapons to deter Vladimir Putin from invading, but not so many that it provokes him into invading, right? So then what happened? A couple months later, he invaded. So either one, they were lying to the New York Times and they carefully calibrated it to provoke him into invading, or they really suck at calibrating how many weapons they should pour into where in order to get Vladimir Putin to do what they want. And you get to choose, or they're lying about what they wanted him to do, you know, again. But so you see there where you take it at face value, their careful calibration of how they modify others' behavior doesn't necessarily work so well. And look at the string of wars over the last, let's be generous and just say 20 years in everybody's living memory since September 11th, where we got absolutely nothing, nothing out of the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, oh, that dirty war in Syria. All of this, just absolute satanic level evil that America has perpetrated on the people of the Middle East. And what do they got to show for it? Nothing. Except now they have to promise Saudi Arabia a new NATO and Israel so that they'll allow us to get back into the treaty we already signed with Iran, keeping them from nuclear weapons they weren't making in the first place, which is also in the book. So these people could very easily miscalculate. I'll tell you an anecdote here from just a couple of weeks ago. John Mearsheimer, who ought to be considered America's greatest hero at this point for the reason he speaks on the Russia issue from the position he speaks it at the University of Chicago and essentially considered dean of the realist school, real politics, sort of Henry Kissinger school of foreign policy in America. He was on the PBS NewsHour and he was on versus Evelyn Farkas, who's a real hawk from the Obama government. And they agree. The newscaster, I believe, sets out the whole syllogism and everybody assents to the entire argument as valid and sound. That, okay, here we go. One, the Russians have said they will not use nuclear weapons unless they feel like the existence of their state is threatened. Two, they could consider a loss of a war in Ukraine to threaten the existence of their state. Three, we're doing everything we can to make sure they lose the war in Ukraine. And then four, so what's your conclusion, Mearsheimer? And he goes, this is crazy. He goes, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which this is essentially directly comparable to, Jack Kennedy was talking to Khrushchev. We're not even talking to the Russians right now. This is insane. And then Evelyn Farkas says, nah, come on. I'm confident the Russians will signal to us before they start using nuclear weapons. And then I don't think Mearsheimer got a chance to say, yeah, but Vladimir Putin himself and his foreign minister and his defense minister, and I think his deputy defense minister, have all threatened to use nuclear weapons since this war began, including Putin, like the day after he started it, when he said, you better stay out because you know I can decimate your entire nation off the face of the earth, et cetera. I'm paraphrasing poorly, but that was what he said. He threatened nuclear war. And Evelyn Farkas goes, no, I'm sure they'll send us a signal. Well, they've been sending us signals in plain spoken Russian. This could turn into a nuclear war if you people don't back off. They keep saying, this is where Kathy Young says, oh, you just believe them. Yeah, I believe them. When they're threatening me with A and H bombs, I believe them. I think we should take that seriously when they say this is our red line. And look, think about America, what we would do. You know, I think it was McGregor taught me, and I should have already known this. I'm sure you know this, Tom, that after the Civil War, the French were in Mexico. And I guess it was Andrew Johnson marched the troops to the border and told the French, you better get or we're going to invade. Monroe Doctrine, in effect, we were distracted for a minute, but now we're not. Beat it. And this was, of course, the Zimmerman telegram is how we got into World War I. The Germans fancifully promised the Mexicans they would help the Mexicans retake the Southwest from us, I don't know, someday, if they would, you know, pick a fight with us to try to keep us out of the war in Europe. And that was enough for a declaration of war from the Congress, which of course led to the rise of communism and Nazism and World War II and the world empire and the rest. So you would think that America, with as jealous as we are of our Monroe Doctrine and its priorities here, and we presume to extend that to the entire planet, you know, it seems like it would make sense for us to imagine that other major powers, mid-rank powers even, might have something like a Monroe Doctrine. Look at Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh, they killed 3 million of his countrymen. He said, F you, bring it. We're not giving in. And Nixon just carpet bombed them. You've all seen the footage. Just carpet bombed them. Sent John McCain in there to blow up their light bulb factories. And they said, F you, we will not quit ever. People got their red lines. And I've been advised this by real experts. I'm not one. I'm just a guy over here. But I've been advised this before, that to the military men A nuke is just another kind of bomb. And if the biggest bomb in your inventory that you've used so far isn't working, you use a bigger one. And that's how generals think. And you might say, no, no, not in America, but okay, how about in Pakistan or in China or, you know, some Russian general you've never heard of and the way he conceives of things, you don't know. And to Pat Buchanan, Pat says, and this is the most important thing I've, you know, noted from him, I think, in the last 20 years here or more, is we used to draw the line at the Elbe River halfway across Germany. And we told the Reds, you better not try to conquer West Germany and France and then, you know, move on Britain. We'll go to nuclear war before we let you do that. That was the line. But then, since Bill Clinton, we moved the line 1,200 miles east, all the way to Russia's border. Now they're going to bring Finland in too. And this whole dispute is about them making Ukraine a de facto member of NATO. And I think any just disinterested observer from anywhere on the planet and should be from your county and mine could just look at this and say, America, you're pushing your luck. You're cruising for a bruising. You're way out over your skis. And you need to be more reasonable in the way that you exercise power. This is reckless. And it's reckless against a country which, yes, has something like 6,500, 7,000 H-bombs, about 1,400 of which are at the ready right now. And it's just, it's insane. And also, yeah, so listen, our government is run by Evelyn Farkas's, right? It's not run by John Mearsheimer's. I mean, it could be that in certain circumstances that Joe Biden is the most cautious man in the room when they're arguing about this stuff in the Oval Office, Tom. You know, like that time that Dick Cheney demanded that W. Bush shoot missiles at the Russian tanks coming under the Caucasus Mountains. It's a tunnel called the Roki Tunnel. And this is when Georgia, trying to get into NATO, they were trying to resolve their border dispute so they could get into NATO, as Bush promised them, attacked South Ossetia and killed Russian peacekeepers there. And then the Russians came over the mountains and under the mountains to push the Georgians back out again. And Dick Cheney demanded that W. Bush shoot missiles into the tunnel and collapse the tunnel and kill the Russian infantry and, you know, armored divisions coming through there. And W. Bush was like, what? No. But he could have dropped dead of a heart attack the day before, and it would have been up to Dick Cheney to decide. And in that case, luckily, you know, it was, they were halfway through 2008 by then, and Bush was not that brave. Give me a break by then, right? He wasn't going to do that. But still, I mean, that was by two, you know, very credible reporters. One of them was Ron Suskind. I forgot who the other one was, but there were two different stories about that that seemed pretty credible about that was what Cheney was demanding. So then what would happen from there? That they would just back down? McMaster, who likes to say, oh, everything wrong in the world is because America's retreating from its role of global domination. Well, when he was national security advisor under Trump, he said we should attack North Korea. He called them bloody nose strikes, where we'll just bomb their nuclear program and their missile program, and then we'll stop. And then they better know that they better just sit there and take it. And then what? And then that's it. That's the plan. Even though because of George W. Bush, who broke the deal, him and John Bolton, who broke the deal and essentially forced the North Koreans to get nukes, they got nukes, a couple of dozen at least, workable implosion bombs. And maybe the delivery systems, certainly enough to hit South Korea and American forces there. And so, yeah, I mean, look, McMaster, he's a war criminal. I interviewed a guy who almost arrested him, a military policeman who almost arrested him in Iraq for his abuse of prisoners at Tal Afar. He was in charge of abolishing corruption in Afghanistan during the Petraeus surge. The guy's a pathetic loser. The guy's a stupid moron. They give him all this credit and say he's a brilliant genius because he wrote this book that the generals didn't give good advice to the civilians during Vietnam. That good advice? Double, triple, quadruple down until we kill that commie enemy good and dead. But that we don't have enough forces to do it yet. Oh, wow, how brave of him to, you know, write that after the fact. The guy's a moron. He could have got us into a nuclear war just a couple of years. Again, just like W. Bush in 08. This is the cool, patient wisdom of Donald Trump. Said, I don't think I'm going to take your advice on that. You know? So yeah, could it happen? It could happen, Tom. It could happen.
Scott, we could definitely do another episode because there's so much more to talk about. The brief section on the nuclear industrial complex made me think, geez, how did I not realize I should have known there was such a thing? You know, there's a blah, blah, blah industrial complex for every rotten part of American society, whether it's right. prisons or medicine or whatever, there's some complex that grows up around it. But let's save that for the future. For now, I want to suggest to people that this is a rather important topic, you know, the potential end of the world. So you might consider looking into it via Scott's book, Hotter Than the Sun, Time to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. I'll have it linked at tomwoods.com/2157. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, everybody, before we wrap up for today, I have something very unusual for you, but it goes to show just how diverse and interesting the Tom Woods audience is. I have in my audience a professional cello player with more than 30 years experience in Hollywood studios, Broadway shows, and symphony orchestras. And if you are interested in learning to play the cello, you can learn from a Tom Woods show listener who is a pro with more than 30 years experience. How do you do such a wonderful thing? You go to his website. And his website is named after himself. It makes sense. His name is Victor Lawrence, and it's spelled just the way you would think Victor Lawrence would be spelled. It's victorlawrencecello.com. So Victor, L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E, cello, C-E-L-L-O.com. victorlawrencecello.com. Maybe you weren't thinking about playing the cello until just now when I mentioned it on this episode of the Tom Woods Show. But my goodness, wouldn't your life take an interesting turn if all of a sudden you could tell people, by the way, I play the cello? Do you realize how we look at people who play the blankety-blank cello? It's like they belong to some other universe or something. You do what? That's incredible. You play the cello? And now you can learn the cello. This is your lucky day, because not only can you learn the cello, but you can learn it from somebody who probably likes Lysander Spooner and thinks we should privatize the roads, you know? So this is just fantastic. So victorlawrencecello.com is where to go. And if you would like to get publicity for a website you are thinking of creating, then before you create that website, go to tomwoods.com/publicity. And I'll tell you how you can get free publicity from me, as well as several other bonuses that will give you a great start out of the gate. So I'll have that website listed at tomwoods.com/2157. And thanks so much for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.